It's time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Scott Weber standing in for Kevin O'Neill. I'd like to welcome everybody to the Capital Thinking radio show, and what I'm sure will be another diverse and interesting session of Capital Thinking. Financial regulation, healthcare reform, tax cuts, and energy regulation are on tap today. And we're going to start off with Todd Cranford, a former senior counsel to the House of Representatives Committee on Financial Services, and Lindsay Weber, a Republican operative and lawyer specializing in financial and regulatory advice and policy. I'd like to start off with an update on the Dodd-Frank rulemaking process. So, Todd, maybe you could take us through that, please.
Yeah, and good afternoon, Scott, and good afternoon, Lindsay, and everyone else. It's hectic, to say the least.
I think what probably isn't hectic in Washington now, right?
Yeah, particularly as the snow is coming down here. But as most folks on the line probably are aware, the Dodd-Frank Act calls for over 200 rulemakings to be made over a period of time, some with very specific deadlines and time frames, and then others less specific. And over, in addition to the 200 designated rules, in the legislation also permits many of these agencies, particularly the Financial Consumer Protection Bureau, to adopt and to promulgate and adopt additional rules. So in the end, there's no telling exactly how many rules may emanate from Dodd-Frank. For example, the CFTC and the SEC have already been well into their rulemaking proposals. In fact, the CFTC, as we speak, is considering SES, which are the swap execution facilities, which will, the legislation requires that certain over-the-counter derivatives be traded and executed on these SEFs. And the CFTC, the SEC, will have to do a number of joint rulemakings, as will some other agencies, including the Fed, along the way. So that process is well underway.
Todd, I have to compliment you. As someone who spent some time in Washington myself, you've mastered the use of acronyms. and I appreciate you explaining for the audience what those acronyms are.
Exactly, because I know I sometimes forget. You have to know your audience. So yes, whenever possible, I try to break it down. Securities and Exchange Commission, Commodities Futures Trading Commission, two of the principal agencies responsible for the capital markets, looking at both equities and derivatives. They obviously do have a little bit of overlap and then some very discrete and specific jurisdiction over the markets. So, yes, they have been and will continue to be very active in their rulemaking over the next several months.
Lindsay, how do you think the change in Congress will affect the timing of the rules?
Well, actually, as Todd was saying, both of those agencies right now have been extremely active. They're actually meeting almost weekly to promulgate rules. Right now, they're coming out on about a four-a-week basis, and that's regardless of the fact that Congress has slowed down, it being a lame duck session, and all of that. But actually, this week, Chairman Gensler from the CFTC went up on Capitol Hill, and he was called to a hearing in the House Agriculture Committee, and he told the committee that there's going to be some rulemakings that just slip with the deadlines. And that's, you know, something that we expected to see happen because of the number of rulemakings that they're asked to perform and the quick time, you know, turnaround that they're having to do to get it there. But at this point, we're not sure how many exactly will slip.
And I would just add from a very practical point to what Lindsay just noted, there's a hiring freeze in the federal government right now. And so the heightened or the additional work that these agencies are now required to do just for this piece of legislation, much less, you know, everything else that was already on their agendas, they do not have the personnel necessarily right now to be able to do all these rulemakings in the timelines prescribed by the legislation. So I think right now we are beginning to see what will continue to be the tension between what is directed in the legislation and what is just physically possible.
And well, addition to the hiring freeze, the change in the composition of Congress with many, many new folks coming in,
right?
Do you think that that will have an effect on the timing of the rules?
Yep, I do. How much of an effect, I think, still remains to be seen, but it's clear that the new majority in the House and the weakened majority in the Senate of Democrats will have much more difficulty getting things through. The leadership of the House, for example, is on record saying that they want to have vigorous oversight of the Dodd-Frank implementation, in particular the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, one of the linchpins and cornerstones of the bill, at least per the administration, also one of the most controversial. And soon-to-be Chairman Spencer Baucus from Alabama is on record as saying that he wants to have vigorous oversight. He has sent letters to Treasury and to the CFPB, to the Inspector Generals at the Fed and at the Treasury, seeking information on just what's happening with the organization of that particular bureau and how money is being spent and who's making decisions over there.
And if I could just add to that.
It sounds like Baucus and ICE and some others who will have oversight responsibility are pretty geared up for the 112th Congress.
Yes.
How do you think that congressional oversight on Dodd-Frank will impact the rulemaking process?
Go ahead, Lindsay. I think you were getting ready to say something.
Well, and it was on that exact point. The ways in which we see it affecting the agencies being able to do their rulemakings is simply in the fact that the more oversight that Congress decides to have over the process, it's just going to slow the process down. When our chairmen from both agencies have to be on Capitol Hill testifying, have to be providing additional studies to Capitol Hill explaining what they're doing, when, you know, as Todd explained, they're already on a very tight budget with a very extremely, you know, taxed staff, there's just not enough hands going around. And so I think that they're doing the best that they can do to keep every rulemaking on the schedule that was dictated in the Dodd-Frank bill. But, you know, they're only human, and it's just going to have to fall at some point, we think.
So reading between the lines, Lindsay, it sounds like a lot of the scheduling will likely slip.
Well, I think they're going to do the best that they can to stay on schedule, but you know, as Gensler said yesterday in the House Ag Committee, you know, some of the rulemakings they're just going to have to ask for an extension or get an extension on.
And yes. This is also presupposing that there are no additional emergencies or crises that occur during this rulemaking process. I mean, heaven forbid there should be another, you know, economic crisis that, you know, just draws resources and attention away from the rulemaking because, you know, issues have to be dealt with immediately. That obviously can slow things down as well.
Heaven forbid substance gets in the way of process in Washington, right?
Well, it's interesting that you say that because I think one of the other challenges, particularly given some of the timelines of these rulemakings, that the regulators are going to face are, you know, time and efficacy. They want to get it right. You know, these are all, you know, very professional analysts, attorneys, and others involved in these rulemakings, and they want to get it right. But sometimes these deadlines, I think, will maybe stifle or hinder their ability to do as much analysis as they would like because they don't want to have these challenged in court because someone claims that they, you know, didn't do sufficient economic analysis, for example, often referred to as the cost-benefit analysis. There have been a number of challenges over the past few years to a number of federal rulemakings because with claims, not necessarily all successful, but at least claims that the rulemakings were not supported by sufficient economic analysis. And that, again, may not derail a rulemaking, but it can slow it down.
Well, let me tee up one more issue, and Lindsay, maybe I can ask you to start on this. What do you think their chances of legislation passing that could weaken or modify Dodd-Frank?
I think that is a pretty broad question. It's difficult to answer in the abstract. We do know that with the new Congress coming in, that they do plan to look at certain issues within the Dodd-Frank bill to determine whether or not the way that the language in the legislation was written is correct, is appropriate. But we don't see many parts that we expect to be, you know, for example, completely weakened or modified. We see more of an oversight push going on in Capitol Hill right now.
I would agree with that, that you know, the House may pass a few pieces of legislation that may weaken or try to modify legislation, but the odds of it being passed in the Senate as well and, of course, being signed by the President, I think, are slim to none.
Todd and Lindsay, thank you very much for your time and insight. We greatly appreciate it. We'll be back.
Have a great day.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle, whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on. Boom.
Golf, racing, or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Welcome back, everybody. We move from Dodd-Frank to healthcare reform. Returning to our program today, our policy specialist, Julie Black, who worked on the Hill for Senator Richard Lugar, and Kendall Hussey, who worked for Senator Richard Burr. Thank you for joining us, ladies. We appreciate it.
Absolutely.
This week, we saw a federal district court judge rule that the individual mandate in the health care reform law is unconstitutional. What can you tell us about this ruling, and what do you think it means for the future of health care reform?
Well, that's correct. This past Monday, December 13th, Judge Henry Hudson, a federal court judge in Virginia, ruled in favor of the state's constitutional challenge to the federal health reform law. And as you just stated, the judge struck down the individual mandate that requires that everyone obtain health insurance. But his ruling included a severability clause, so therefore he did not rule out that other provisions of the law would be considered unconstitutional. The Virginia Attorney General, Ken Cuccinelli, who brought the suit against the reform law, had hoped the entire law would be nullified, but he still considered this ruling a pretty major victory. And it was expected that the Attorney General would push to move this as fast as he could to be considered by the Supreme Court, but now has stated that he's hesitant to move forward without support from the Department of Justice. And the Virginia Governor, Bob McDonnell, has urged that, you know, both sides seek to waive a hearing in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is where the case would go next, and move directly to the Supreme Court. But Obama administration officials have confirmed they do not intend to push for any type of expedited review of this case. Regardless, this ruling does set in motion a potential appeal to the Supreme Court. And I also want to note that the Virginia challenge is one of several cases filed against the Affordable Care Act. Just today, in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Florida, arguments are being heard about a case brought by 20 attorney generals of the states, as well as the National Federation of Independent Businesses. And their arguments are focused on the individual mandate, but also include arguments against what Congress did with the Medicaid expansion, which is a piece of the other lawsuits do not include. At least one of the lawsuits is likely to be heard by the Supreme Court in the next couple of years.
How did President Obama and other Democrats react to this seemingly pretty significant ruling?
You know, President Obama actually brushed it aside and really played down its significance. You know, he simply just kind of shrugged his shoulders and said, you know, this is one ruling by one federal district court. The House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Sandra Levin noted that 14 similar cases have been dismissed in the courts and two have been decided in favor of the Affordable Care Act. And he was very confident that after review at the appellate level, you know, the case would be decided in favor of the law.
Well, let me toss this over to our other guest. Also released the same day as the ruling was a very interesting poll on how the public perceives the health care reform law. Can you comment on that?
Sure. Yeah, actually, you know, I'll take this question if you don't mind.
Sure.
On Monday, there was an ABC News Washington Post poll that found that 43% of Americans are still skeptical on the health care reform law. 52% of those surveyed oppose the overhaul measure. But honestly, the public's views really have not changed considerably over time. The highest level of support came about a year ago when 48% said they supported it. The Kaiser Family Foundation has found very similar results. And, you know, long story short, the Obama administration still obviously has a lot to do to win over naysayers against the law. But I suspect at this point, you know, they're more focused on the jobs and the economy. And we'll just continue forward with implementation.
Let's change gears for a moment to evaluate the activities Congress is undertaking in the final moments of the 111th Congress before they go on break. Can you tell me what has been accomplished on the healthcare agenda and what remains?
Sure. So there are a couple of things that have been going on as the clock ticks to the final, what we hope will be the final hours here in the next few days. Among the last orders of business during the 111th Congress, the House and Senate both passed the Medicare and Medicaid Extenders Act of 2012, and that was legislation that was introduced by leadership in the Senate, Senator Harry Reid, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, and then also Senate Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus and Ranking Member Chuck Grassley. And the legislation will prevent a cut in Medicare payments for physicians by providing a 0% update for calendar year 2011. The bill also includes several one-year extensions of expiring Medicare provisions, including an extension of the exceptions process for the Medicare therapy caps through the end of next year. Also, another few extenders were included, and Congress at this point has almost done routine extensions of all of those provisions. The Senate passed the legislation by unanimous consent on December 8th, and the House followed suit by passing the legislation on December 9th. And just last night, the president signed the bill into law. So physicians should be pretty happy that they will have a one-year reprieve from a little bit of the debate on extension of preventing the significant payment cuts that they were facing. But looking ahead into the 112th Congress, Republicans are really pushing a strategy to tie a more permanent physician fee fix to defunding provisions of the health care reform law. And specifically, Republicans are considering using the Prevention and Public Health Fund as an offset for the fix. And then on the House side, reforming physician payment and not doing these continual fixes is really a key agenda item for House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Dave Camp. So we expect some activity to fall in that area next year.
Julie, do you think there will be any other health care legislation before year's end, or are we done with what we're going to say?
Well, that question is really up in the air at this point. There is some buzz that the Senate Finance Committee staff are considering introducing a small, non-controversial package of Medicare fixes, and we expect that these would include things that were not lumped into the SGR fix, the Medicaid Extenders Act of 2012. And Senate Republican leadership limited the scope of those packages to just SGR, provisions that were previously included in a House technical corrections package, and the sort of what I call the routine Medicare extenders that I mentioned earlier. So the package that's potentially going to surface would be a small package costing in the neighborhood of $250 million and would be offset using funds from the Medicare Improvement Fund. At this point, you know, the buzz is that the legislation may include a retroactive pay adjustment for doctors in rural areas, a technical correction to the end-stage renal disease prospective payment system, revisions to hospice regulations, and establishment of a demonstration program to cover the cost of certain intravenous drugs. Given the year-end agenda and the clock ticking, the legislation would most likely need to move by unanimous consent to have a shot at moving. But like I said, we'll see if even a package surfaces. Outlook is uncertain at best.
Thank you, Julie. One more for you. Given the new House Republican majority, the deficit is going to be a significant issue, and it has been a significant issue. Earlier this year, the president convened a National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform. Do you think this sets the stage for work that Congress may undertake in 2011?
I certainly think so. The commission adjourned its meeting on December 3rd without having the necessary 14 votes to pass its deficit reduction plan. And this is a plan that included cuts in federal health care payments and would have reduced the growth of federal debt by about $3.8 trillion by 2012. So 11 members of the commission indicated that they would have supported the proposal. That included 7 Democrats and 4 Republican appointees. Notably, though, the only Senate Democrat who voted against or would have voted against the proposal is Senate Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus. So it'll be interesting to see where he lands in the mix of things next year. But the draft proposal noted that it's necessary to fix the sustainable growth rate problem and that the fee fix should be offset. It also made reference to additional ways to reduce healthcare spending, such as placing dual eligible beneficiaries in Medicaid managed care, cutting Medicare payments for bad debt, expanding accountable care organizations and payment bundling, among other payment reforms, as well as reducing federal spending on Medicaid administrative costs. The draft proposal, sort of a fly-by-night provision that was probably overlooked by a number of people, was that it revisited or suggested revisiting a public option or an all-payer system within the exchange. This was certainly a point of debate during health care reform, so to see it surface again, I think, gave people a bit of concern. The proposal also suggested overhauling the fee-for-service system and expanding the authority of the Independent Payment Advisory Board, which was authorized in health care reform. It's notable because the executive order establishing the President's Commission and the Commission's charter do not require Congress to vote on the final report. However, Senate Majority Leader Reid has signaled that he would like to vote on the Commission's report. Earlier in the month, he had suggested that that would be something that could occur in the lame duck session. Although, as we've stated, given the agenda and the ticking clock, it's really unlikely to happen. And the House Republicans have not committed to bringing the report to a floor vote, and I don't expect that they would do so. So we may see some other activities. Senate Budget Committee Chairman Kent Conrad is pressing to convene a bipartisan deficit reduction summit. The White House has indicated that they'll meet with members of the commission to consider whether any parts of the proposal might be appropriate for inclusion in the 2012 fiscal year budget. And then finally, incoming House Majority Leader Representative Eric Cantor has called for weekly spending votes in the House next year, so the deficit will most certainly continue to be a theme, but the commission's proposal is not likely to take on a new life.
Julie and Kendall, thank you very much. We'll be back with The Dirtiest Word in Washington.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjoe Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about the show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjoe Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
Business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Welcome back to Capital Thinking. This is Scott Weber in for Kevin O'Neill today. Let's get a little racy and talk about the dirtiest word in Washington, D.C. right now, taxes. We have two experts with us, Vincent Felici. He's worked for many political heavyweights, including President Clinton and Senator Chris Dodd, and Manny Rossman, who has over a decade of experience working on the Hill in both the House and the Senate. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us today. And let me throw the first question out to Manny. Manny, will the Democrats be able to reunite after this tax compromise where the House Democrats were shut out?
I think the answer is yes. It may be a question better asked of Vince, but I think that you're already going to, by the virtue of the vote in the Senate yesterday on the tax bill, which was overwhelming in nature, 81-19, I think you're going to get probably, when the House votes today on a tax bill, a fairly sizable Democratic vote. which means that, that inroads from the White House to the House Democratic Caucus are already occurring, and I think are going to prove to be fairly successful, even with respect to this bill. My take on what we've seen in the last week or so out of the House Democratic Caucus is catharsis. They weren't that far off from their Senate counterparts as to where they stood ideologically on this. The major difference being that Senator Max Baucus, who was the Senate Democratic chief negotiator on the tax bill, signed off on the deal. The House Republicans, the House Democratic negotiator Chris Van Hollen apparently did not, although it's unclear precisely whether he was in the room when the deal was cut or not. But that difference notwithstanding, I think that Senate Democrats came around, and the 44 out of their caucus of 58 actually voted for passage of the bill yesterday. And I think that that's proof positive that while there are continue to be strong emotions associated with this bill and quote unquote lowering taxes for the rich. And they focus their ire on the estate tax provisions in the bill. I don't think that this is insurmountable as a division between the president and the caucus. I have no reason to believe that there's going to be a long-lasting effect, other than I think that the professional left, to coin a term, I guess, or repeat a term, has been disenchanted with various elements of the Obama agenda for some time. So that'll probably continue to be the case, but I'm not sure that I see a lot of fallout from it.
And also, what do you think the long-lasting damages to Obama will be, if any?
Well, long-lasting damage in terms of Obama pursuing his agenda through Congress and
yes,
his relationship
and
with the House
re-election.
Well, I think it's an interesting question, and time will tell. Certainly, going forward, the House Democratic Caucus is going to be probably less ideologically diverse than it is today. With a number of moderate Democrats losing their reelection, and they won't be returning in January. My sense is that there is a chunk of the caucus that probably doesn't trust the president and where he's going, but so much remains to be seen as to what the agenda that the president's going to push is that it's a little bit difficult to handicap what his relationship with House Democrats is going to be on particular issues. So I think there's a degree of skepticism and distrust from some. My guess is that's a minority. It's a very vocal minority of the minority. And, the president has to chart a course, and it's going to be very interesting to see whether he chooses to pivot, as he has on the tax bill, and work with both sides, and perhaps alienate, the very liberal base of the party. Or whether there's going to be an opportunity for him to make the base happy too.
Gentlemen, what do you think are the prospects that President Obama will launch a campaign for wide-ranging overhaul on tax reform? Vince, are you on?
Yeah, I'm on. Yeah, I would say that they're very high. I mean Manny does a lot more work in the tax area than I do on a day-to-day basis, so he may have some better thoughts on this. I can speak to the politics, and I think politically, dovetailing off of this vote, which is happening today in the House and the vote in the Senate, let's remember it's an extension. It's a two-year extension. And I think that politically what the White House is going to do, what they want to do here, is to try to move quickly around this, pivot, right, to use what Manny just said, away from this torturous intra-party squabble over an extension issue and change the topic on taxes quickly to a full overhaul. Now, traditionally nothing really happens in the second 2 years of a president's first term. It's the first 2 years of the first term, and if he gets a second one, it's the first 2 years of the second term. So, in my opinion, I think it doesn't go anywhere, but I think that the White House will put out a very robust proposal, and then it'll be interesting to see what happens on the Hill.
So, who gets the better end of this deal, the Republicans or the Democrats?
Well, that's a good question. If I could just dovetail on what Vince said, and then I can get into my opinions on the next question. I think with respect to wide-ranging tax reform, it does sound as though there are significant discussions occurring in the White House and within the administration on whether they want to actually pursue wide-ranging tax reform next year. Just a couple of points. The White House won't alone be able to set the agenda with the Republican House. I think the House Republicans are going to pursue a wide-ranging agenda that is focused probably largely on, as defined by them, jobs in the economy. I think that deficit reduction will be a key component of that. And I think that there's a chance that that should Obama pursue in a serious manner tax reform and restructuring of either or both of the individual or corporate sides of the code, that's a potential area where he could work with House Republicans and you know, Senate Democrats and Republicans alike. Now, whether he does that, I think, remains an open question. And I don't doubt that there will be elements of, you know, tax restructuring proposals in his budget, but I'd only point out that I think Vince is right. Tax reform on a broad scale will not happen unless, it may not happen even if, but certainly not unless the president makes it a real priority and really throws his weight behind it. Even then, there are challenges, and Vince already enumerated them. But what I do know is that if he doesn't make it the focal point or a focal point of his agenda, it probably will not happen. If you look historically at the major tax and deficit legislation enacted over the years, I'd be hard-pressed to find an example where the president didn't have to push with all his might to actually get it over the line. You could look at Clinton's balanced budget, various aspects of Reagan's tax reform, the 1986 bill being a good example, and there are others as well. With respect to your next question, which I think was who got the better end of the tax deal.
Who got the better end of the deal, the Republicans or the Democrats, Manny?
That's really a fascinating question, and you've got the darling of the left, Paul Krugman, who says that Republicans pulled one over on Obama and that he's not fighting. And you've got Charles Krauthammer on the right arguing that this is stimulus in disguise and Republicans never should have accepted such a deal from Obama.
Why don't you use darling to describe Krauthammer, Manny?
Yeah, I was actually going to. But you've got, you've really got a situation where both sides got something. In my opinion, Democrats averted disaster, disaster being a major tax increase on all Americans, but from a political standpoint, most sensitive to a roughly $3,000 per family tax increase for 2011 for middle income Americans, an average middle income American family who would probably feel the effect of that come their first paycheck in January, and they probably got, from their perspective, a better deal than they would in January were this bill not to pass, which we believe it will today. So you might ask, why did Republicans agree to such a deal? Why didn't they do it on terms where they could control it a little bit more come January, where they have a Republican House and a more evenly divided Senate? And I think the answer is that I think responsibility prevailed. I hesitate to speak in the past tense because the House hasn't passed anything yet, but let's assume that this bill passes today, which I think is a good assumption. There are a lot of Republicans that it'd probably be tempting to use the excuse of this isn't doesn't make the Bush tax cuts permanent, or we haven't paid for the, I think it's a roughly $60 billion price tag for the 13-month extension for unemployment insurance for the long-term unemployed. There are different reasons that you can either quibble or outright dislike this legislation. But I think what's undeniable is that, and Larry Summers laid this out, I think, for the first time last week, there's really a potential for economic calamity without extending these the tax rates for at least a couple more years. And I'll end my filibuster by saying that this isn't a perfect bill from either perspective. I do think that if you look at it from, you know, look back 6, 8, 12 months ago, it's fairly stunning to see the president not just signing but championing legislation that extends the tax cuts for everybody.
Well, Vince, we got about 30 seconds left. Parting comments?
I think the president got the better end of the deal. Not Democrats in general, but the president did. I think that this was a deal that puts the president himself in a better position for his reelection chances, because if the economy stays where it is and we only have 2% growth and unemployment stays up in the nines, as many economists project, literally for 2 more years or more, then he can make the argument that he agreed to a $900 billion tax cut, which was bigger than his $700 billion stimulus, both of which wouldn't have worked by then. And if the economy is better, he takes credit.
Well, Manny and Vince, as always, you're great guests, and we really appreciate the insight. And thank you very much. Have a great afternoon, gentlemen.
Thanks, Scott.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than 4 decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business,
you'll find the experts here.
Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Hello, everyone. It's Scott Weber in for Kevin O'Neill. For our final segment, we'll address recent initiatives that FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, undertook in the areas of penalty guidelines and rulemaking proceedings involving the smart grid and integration of renewable resources into the transmission grid. We're honored today to have Meredith Jolivere, who has extensive experience representing clients in the electricity and natural gas industries, as well as Lodi White, a former FERC staff attorney. Ladies, thank you for joining us today. And let me throw the first question out to Lodi. Lodi, the energy industry is still a hot topic. Can you tell us what's been going on recently at the FERC?
Thanks, Scott. Well, you know, over the past year, FERC has prioritized a number of initiatives by issuing several rulemakings and significant orders. These include tackling issues such as transmission. FERC has gained insight on the major challenges that are surrounding the current transmission infrastructure and has taken action to bolster investments and to promote electric power reliability while lowering costs for consumers by reducing transmission congestion. Some of these initiatives include integration of renewables into the grid, recovering construction costs for transmission that serves multiple states, and determining who is responsible for paying these costs.
Meredith, how does the rulemaking process at FERC give clients another opportunity to shape the law? And what are some of the most effective ways that you have advocated for your clients within the context of FERC's rulemakings?
That's an interesting question, Scott. And one of the things I've tried to do is educate people about my practice and explain that the rulemaking process provides clients with another bite at the apple, so to speak, to shape law. If, for instance, a client used our public policy advocacy to help shape legislation like the Energy Policy Act, the Energy Independence and Security Act, or the ENO Act, FERC's rulemakings implementing provisions, or any agency actually implementing provisions of that legislation, can help provide our clients with another opportunity to actually shape the rules that will implement that legislation. And so what we've done in our practice is draft comments on the proposed rules. We've facilitated in-person meetings with the commissioners and their staff that have given our clients an opportunity to get before the commission, explain their point of view and what is really at issue and at stake in a lot of these rulemakings, and has helped the clients better understand the direction the commission's headed in.
Thanks, Meredith. Lodi, let's go international for a moment. Germany has attracted much attention for being in the forefront of renewable energy technology. What is FERC doing to put renewables on the forefront in the U.S.?
Well, Scott, you know, it's true. Germany has been doing, has been excelling at putting solar industry on the map. But just this past month, FERC proposed reforms to its rules to lay the foundation for integrating the rapid growth of variable energy resources into the nation's grid while trying to balance reliability of the bulk power system and bringing, again, savings to customers. In this rulemaking, FERC is proposing to require things like public utility transmission providers to offer all customers the option to schedule transmission service into hourly, and that's usually, they're looking at 15-minute increments instead of the current hourly scheduling procedure. The more frequent scheduling intervals will provide greater accuracy in scheduling and mitigate the amount of ancillary services that customers will need to supply or purchase. So basically, it's helping renewables get into the grid while, again, keeping the cost to customers in mind.
So definitely some lessons to be learned there for
yes,
us.
Yes, and this is an ongoing process. This, again, it's, at this point, it's a notice of proposed rulemaking. Comments will be are scheduled to come in on March 2nd, where stakeholders can say what it is they like or do not like about the rulemaking, say what is or is not feasible. And FERC is going to take those comments in consideration before issuing a final rule, at which, at that point, the industry will have to abide by.
Lodi, you mentioned notice of proposed rulemaking. Let me turn to Meredith now. Meredith, the FERC's transmission planning and cost allocation, NOPR, was criticized recently in the Wall Street Journal. What is the status of FERC's proceeding, and what's at issue for consumers?
You know, it's interesting because the Wall Street Journal article appeared on November 9th and really demonstrates to me how mainstream a lot of these transmission infrastructure and cost allocation issues have become. the last time I was on the show, I talked about an Energy Law Journal article that I co-authored with Debbie Swanstrom in our energy practice that addressed the Energy Policy Act of 2005 and FERC's backstop transmission siting authority. The commission's NOPR actually deals with a different set of issues to address sort of the historic barriers to transmission investment and the creation of a dynamic market to build the infrastructure necessary to integrate all of these renewable resources that Lodi was just talking about. And so right now, the comment and reply comment deadlines have passed. The NOPR was issued. We facilitated some in-person meetings for some of our clients and have filed comments in the proceeding as well. We are waiting for a final rule from the commission now, and ultimately how the commission rules will impact how what consumers see, you know, in their pockets, because all of this deals with the cost of transmission and getting energy that you need to the end user, which is the consumer.
Lodi, earlier this year, FERC enhanced its enforcement program by issuing and then later revising its penalty guidelines. In your opinion, what are the most significant aspects of these guidelines, and how can you help your clients avoid being subject to these penalties?
Well, Scott, you know, in March, FERC adopted a policy statement on penalty guidelines for its enforcement program. It was modeled after the U.S. sentencing guidelines, and based its penalty calculations on uniform factors with assigned weights. FERC used a five-step process to determine the penalty range. Stakeholders had the opportunity to submit comments, and while FERC recently issued a revised policy statement, FERC's purpose, it reiterated its purpose of the penalty guideline was to ensure fairness, consistency, and transparency. Given this is a very complicated process, and while we don't have time to go into it at this point, you know, we have expertise at the firm to assist clients to avoid or mitigate penalties.
Meredith and Lodi, thank you very much for appearing again with us and for your insight and expertise. We appreciate it. This is Scott Weber in for Kevin O'Neill, thanking everyone for the opportunity to appear on Capital Thinking and wishing everyone a happy, healthy, and safe holiday season.
Joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.